You went on this show.
You kind of have to keep up with it. It's very intelligent.
It sounds like a scam.
They are not part of the legitimate business world.
This is the Drex Radio Show on KGO 810.
And away we go, live and local in the Bay and around the world at KGORadio.com. Now, back in 1969, Jim Morrison did his final interview with Rolling Stone magazine and just happened to predict the rise of EDM, electronic dance music. Morrison imagined some kind of, kids in a basement somewhere inventing a new genre of music where you could play a whole orchestra on one synthesizer. And he said that one day, that would play to huge crowds. That was 19 years before Skrillex was born and 43 years before Skrillex played with the surviving members of The Doors for the documentary Reference Generation Music. And this is something that came out of that.
The new generation's music will be, it'll have a synthesis of those two elements and some third thing that'll be entirely, maybe it'll be, it might rely heavily on electronics, tapes. I can kind of envision maybe one person with a lot of machines, tapes, and electronic setups, singing or speaking and using machines.
And away we go. Yes. Wow. Skrillex and The Doors. And that brings me to my next guest, Michael Clausen. Thank you very much for joining me, Michael.
Thank you, Drex. Great to be with you.
That's quite a mashup, isn't it? It's amazing.
Oh, it's great. I love it. I love The Doors.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about hippies versus millennials. You are the author of Hippie Incorporated, and you are also a professor at University of Northern Iowa. And boy, we've got Batman versus Superman, Donald Trump versus Ted Cruz, and now hippies versus millennials. It's quite a Friday night. It's quite a good Friday. Yes.
Well, Yeah, go ahead.
Well, one of the things we were talking about, here we are at pretty much ground zero, I think you might agree, the hippie movement, peace, love, drugs, sex, and rock and roll.
Right, yeah, you are. And I spent a lot of my time in your fair city over the last 9 years looking at this. You know, Drex, what I was really interested in was what was the commercial impact of the hippie movement. And, a lot of times we think of the standard, typical hippie clothes, tie-dyes, and so forth. But it was my impression, having lived through some of that it was a little more detailed than that. And what I found was, to put it in a nutshell, was that I found that within a very short period, the very beginning of the hippie movement, basically the fall of 1965 to the fall of 1967, less than 100 weeks, that there was a kind of a core group of hippies in the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood who came up with innovative ideas and products that today I estimate to be worth nearly $1 trillion and to employ millions of people here and abroad.
Wow. And you know what? I love how you compare the two, the millennials, because they're having the similar impact, right?
They are. I've been in the classroom as a professor for 29 years, and I've been involved with higher education for most of 4 decades now. And I have to say, I don't try to flatter people, but this is a distinctive generation we have now in our classrooms. I have not seen this type of approach or attitude to career, to salary, to relationships, really since the 60s. And I'm not saying that, we were any better or any worse. I'm just saying that it's a very comparable situation. I'm hearing students now talking more about the meaning of their lives, and that they need to have more than just to make a lot of money.
Right.
In my book, I say, there's hippies in every generation. It's been that way throughout. I said, and that hippie might be wearing a suit and tie just as well as, Birkenstocks and torn jeans. And having been in a class, university classroom for 30 years, I see hippies in every generation.
Yeah, it's a very cool thing. And I mean, you know, one of the things, especially in the gig economy that we seem to be working with today here in the Bay and mm-hmm. around the country, is they do look at things differently, just as the hippies did. They're mm-hmm. out to do their own thing. They're not down with right. corporations. They're really not down with the government. They're anti-war, right. and they've got their own thing going on.
Well, that's true, and you see that again with the millennials. But, you know, what I do in the book is distinguish fairly carefully with three different movements that were going on in your city. You know, the beatniks who came in the 50s, the hippies in the mid-60s, and then the campus radicals that started really in the early 60s and really then took off in the late 60s. You know, these were very three distinct groups. And, you know, there was a reason the hippies went viral in terms of their products and their ideas and why the Beats and the campus radicals didn't. And that's explored in the book, you know, quite a bit. Now, what made them magical? What made their products generate, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to this day? And then why did that not really take off on the campus movements or the beat movement?
Well, you know, I look back to the hippie generation. Unfortunately, I'm X, Generation Drex. But, you know, so I don't know where I stand with all of this, kind of just watching with each eye. To the left and to the right. But, you know, the hippies had one war, and now we've got this international phenomenon that's a bad thing going on. And I don't, how do you contrast the two?
Well, you know, the thing about it is the one thing we don't realize is that, the original hippies that were there, there were a few of them who were boomers, and some of them were actually distinguished veterans of the Korean War, not the Vietnam War.
Right.
So there was a little different generation. Vietnam came just a little bit during that time and then really got quite wild later on. But I've asked my students, you know, what have you accomplished in your generation? And they kind of look like, well, I guess nothing. I said, are you kidding? I said, man, you were a part of electing the first African-American president. You
right.
fought two wars. One of the, you know, the best successful tech innovators in the world is, 30 years old? Mark Zuckerberg?
Absolutely.
Part of that generation.
Yes.
So, and I think that what happens is that when you're in living that life, you know, living your life, your daily life, you don't really sometimes have the, you know, the ability, whatever, to just reflect on what's going on around you. And that became clear to me when I worked with Mark Brownstein. He worked with Janis Joplin and Big Brother and Cosmic Blues for probably 7 or 8 years of his young adult life. And he said, you know, I never quite got it. And I said, you got to be kidding me, Mark. I mean, you're right in the middle of it. He said, yeah, but I just didn't get it. And I said, well, let me share some of this transcript that God, I'm working on. And he read it. He says, I think I get it. You know, and I think that what happens with each generation is this, life goes on. And they may not actually kind of reflect on just what really is going on around them.
Okay, I've got to take a break, and we'll be back with Michael Clausen, Hippies versus Millennials, and he's the author of Hippie Incorporated. 808-0810 is the number, and we'll be right back. As we continue the conversation, we'll talk about the sexual movement, why not, on both sides, hippies versus millennials, coming up on the Drex Radio Show on KGO810.
The voices in his head may not be real, but they have some really good ideas. The Drex Radio Show on KGO810.
We're talking about hippies versus millennials. And later we'll talk about Batman versus Superman. And Michael Clausen is my guest. He's the author of Hippie Incorporated. And boy, oh boy, you talk about hippies, Michael. I have to tell you, they come running to KGO. I want to take a call here from Chico and Humboldt. Yes, you know what? Now, Chico, you were a hippie. You're still a hippie. Always will be a hippie.
Well, I don't know if that's the right word. As I migrated up here to Humboldt County in 1980 and never left. I go down, you know, to see my mom until she died, so now there's no reason. And I've just been reading Tom Wolfe's Electric Acid Kool-Aid Test again. And it's funny, you know. You guys are talking about that. And, you know, I've been down there. I remember when the hippies left and went north to Mendo.
Well, that's
Sonoma.
Yeah, well, they're up there for a good reason, and the people are still up there today for a good reason, and I thank you. Yes, from that wonderful triangle. Yeah, let's talk about the drug thing. I mean, because back then it was, you know, drop in, drop out, drop in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What was it? What, how did that go? Was it drop out, drop in, drop out? Now it's drop Molly.
Are you asking me?
Yeah. Oh,
you're asking me?
Yes, I'm asking you.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, you know, the what was interesting about the drug thing then is that the primary drugs were LSD and pot.
Right.
And a lot of folks at that time just had the attitude that these were, you know, pretty much soft drugs. And there was a reason they felt that way. For one thing, LSD was legal. For the first half of the very original hippie movement, you could take LSD and eat a peanut butter sandwich, and either one would make you break the law. So there was a feeling that, you know, there was nothing particularly wrong about it. And pot was also seen as a soft drug. A lot of the hippies who were there that I interviewed, now most of them are in their 70s and 80s, they were pretty much agreement that one of the things that created the demise of the community were the drug dealers who came in with the hard drugs, the cocaine and heroin and so on and so forth, and that if they had stuck with that, it would have been a lot better community.
Right. It was turn also, on, you know, turn on, tune in, drop out. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things, too, they said, you know, that what they were trying to do is use the LSD and the pot to kind of have a more of a spiritual awareness, an awareness of themselves and what they were going to, you know, what they wanted to accomplish on this planet. I remember talking to Eric Christensen, who was in his lifetime, he's been a producer at ABC. He was an original hippie. And he said, you know, we didn't use words like, you know, getting trashed. You know, that just wasn't it. It was, you know, getting high or becoming, you know, illuminated and to figure out, you know, just enlightened what's going on.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, so, you know, the hippie mantra was peace, love, drugs, sex, and rock and roll. So what do you think millennials' mantra is?
Well, you know, that's part of the problem is I'm not sure, you know, the drug, sex, and rock and roll has, of course, been the mantra for years.
Yep.
But the problem with that was that it masked what the ingenuity and the innovation and the genius of those folks. You know, it's hard to imagine now, but because our stereotypes are so strong. But we had people in that original community who were certified geniuses. And at that time, it attracted some of the best and brightest. Well, today, with the millennials, you don't need a neighborhood, Drex. You just need to get online. In many ways, today's millennials have far more power, social power, than the hippies ever could even dream of.
Well,
and that's
yeah.
because they are connected virtually.
Sure.
You don't have to go to a 28-block area called the Hate District to get something going. And we see it. We've seen entire countries come down because of the Internet and because of Twitter. And now, of course, now you're doing the thing with Trump and so forth. But, you know, I mean, that to me is silly. But, you know, there you see, again, the power of that situation. You Twitter 16 words and all of a sudden you got the whole nation mesmerized.
Well, sure. And then there is the sexual movement that was the hippies. But today, you know, is the free love versus Tinder, OkCupid, et cetera.
You know, what's interesting about that, I asked them about that. Jay Thelen, for example, he opened up the very first shop on Haight Street that was a hippie shop. That was on January 3, 1966. It was called the Psychedelic Shop. And anybody who was in Haight-Ashbury knew it because it was the epicenter of the whole movement. And Jay told me in several interviews I had with him, he said, that whole sexual revolution was not our idea. He said, that was just bullshit. We would not have done that. And I said, well, who did it? He said, it was the boomers. He said, they came later. And I said, well, what made them move in that direction? He says, well, Mike, think about it. You got 18 to 21-year-old kids. The hormones are going crazy. It had to do with sex, you know. Whereas the original hippies, a lot of them, by the time America even discovered there was something going on, these hippies were 29, 30 years old. And in fact, most of America didn't even know anything was going on until the movement was completely over, as far as the original movement goes.
Well, a lot of them are still hanging out in Dolores Park somewhere. But
yeah, no doubt.
For sure. You know, and I have to say, I think it's, I wonder what it feels like now for the hippies from the day come back into the city and see it taken over with traffic and tech.
You know, I think a lot of them feel nostalgic for the old San Francisco. It's a little simpler.
Right, the gentrification has been.
Yeah. You know, and it's kind of interesting because why did the hippies move to Haight? You know, they were basically the bohemian element of San Francisco was basically centered in North Beach or Little Italy. And why did they move to Haight? You found time and time again, cheaper rent. And they were, you know, they were able to get a big old Victorian house, fill it up with 20 people, and everybody was paying maybe $30 a month for rent. So I think they do, you know, they feel nostalgic for those days. But, you know, that's, of course, is long gone.
Now, parking's $30 an hour now. Left. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think they are, you know, but, you know, that's kind of the march of time. I think that happens with a lot of people. And we're talking about 70-year-old people here, and that they would grumble about it makes complete sense to me. I don't think that's really the issue. I think they have very fond memories of San Francisco. And, you know, I met a lot of the folks who were there right from day one and even in the years leading up to it. And with the exception of two people, they were all wonderfully gracious people, very open. They invited me into our homes. You know, we would spend several nights in their places, eat their meals. They have very good memories, and many of them feel as though that time in their life affected them to this very day, how they do business, how they conduct their relationships, how they conduct their spirituality, and what they believe about
and you know what, Michael,
food and drugs and everything else. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you know what, Michael? And I have a feeling that in decades to come, the millennials will look back who are in the Bay now in San Francisco being successful as tech workers or in the Bay, you know, wherever they're working or in the city, and look back fondly on it because it was and it is a big deal for them.
It is. And, you know, there's so
now
many
is
great
their time.
Characteristics.
Yes.
Yeah, now is the time. This seize the moment. And it was the same for them, only now we're 50 years down the road.
Right.
But, you know, this generation, like I say, I think a very distinctive generation. David Brooks from New York Times had an article called The Self-Reliant Generation. I think he hit the nail right on the head. He said one of the key characteristics of the millennials is this sense of self-reliance. You know, you think about it a little bit. You know, I'm 62. I don't know, you're in your 40s maybe or
50s. No,
I'm 50s. I'm not 50s. And, you know, you and I, if we wanted to, you know, maybe we would got married, we're going to have a baby, we go see a financial advisor, you know, set this stuff up. Now we, you know, just go online. So I'll take care of my own retirement. I'll take care of my own car insurance.
Yes,
I'll take care. You know,
it's
a generation, that just gets on it. And, you know, if they don't really think that there's a lot of opportunity there or just opportunity they don't really want to do, they just go ahead and create their own businesses. And then we're seeing this happen a lot as well.
Yeah, I have a
lot of respect
for them.
I think we're into a new age of entrepreneurship here.
I love it. All right. Well, Michael, I appreciate your time. Michael Clausen is the author of Hippie Inc. And, well, it was a fantastic chat. And come back and visit. And the next time you come to San Francisco, come to the KGO studios and we'll do it again.
Hey, Drex, I will. I plan to be there in about a month. So maybe we'll see each other.
Absolutely.
Then.
We will have you in the studio, I promise.
Okay, thank you, Drex.
All right, Michael, have a great holiday weekend, and we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with John Libertini on KGO 810.
He's a one who likes all her pretty songs. He likes to sing alone, likes to shoot his gun.
That's Sturgill Simpson.
Don't know what it means.
Pretty solid cover of Nirvana's In Bloom, and everything in bloom for this beautiful Easter weekend now in effect throughout the Bay Area. And gorgeous it's going to be, especially tomorrow. John Libertini from the KGO Newsroom joining me.
And, yes, sir. Present.
Well, we love country music. We love the South, but I certainly don't like the politics of what's going on in North Carolina and probably Georgia.
Well, yeah. North Carolina passed a law that overrides all other non-discrimination ordinances. The tipping point was in Charlotte, which is, by Southern standards, like Atlanta, a pretty cosmopolitan city. A lot of folks from the North moved down there, big
Love
banking
Charlotte.
Industry there, and they passed legislation down there to, you know, a series of rights that would protect the LGBT community. But the tipping point, apparently, was that there's a provision in that law that says for any new construction, any new businesses in Charlotte, you'd have to provide a gender-neutral restroom. So if you had a man and if you had a men's room, you had a woman's room, you'd have to have a gender-neutral room for transgender types as opposed
to... Well, that's ridiculous. That in itself is ridiculous.
Well,
but,
that is...
But then the hash...
Which part? Transgender news bathroom part?
Well,
or
yeah,
the...
I think that's silly. That, you know, first of all, that they would demand that they have a transgender bathroom. I mean, pick one. All right? But then what I really hate is anytime Republicans or, well, it's usually the conservatives just going to say, yeah, the hashtag can so safe. Are you kidding me? And by the way, that was the hashtag. When they say they're going to pass religious freedom legislation... You know, it's all about bigotry and hate and discriminating against gays and bisexuals.
Yeah, you've
got transgenders.
You know what? It's interesting because you've got cities like Charlotte, like Atlanta, who are very cosmopolitan, very liberal. Nashville is becoming this way, believe it or not. But
well,
get outside. Well, it should, but it hasn't. But you get outside the city limits, and you've got a whole other thought process. And so. That's where, you know, and let's face it, legislatures are made up of lots of people that represent lots of areas, and there are probably more of those people than the folks that, you know, govern a big city like Charlotte.
This is, you know what, they took the same cue from Houston, Texas, who did the same damn thing, and they made it all about bathrooms, and that was their way to allow them themselves to discriminate against the gay community. It's as simple as that. That's what this is all about.
Well, it is. And what's interesting is that Steph Curry, our own Steph Curry, the NBA MVP of the Golden State Warriors, is from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Oh.
His father was a star with the Charlotte Hornets back in the day. Steph grew up in Charlotte. And Charlotte is in line to get the NBA All-Star Game. And this threatens, and the NBA has told them, like the NFL has told Georgia about the Super Bowl, your bid could be in trouble. Well, Steph was asked about that today following a shoot-around over at Oracle Arena, and he didn't get terribly political about it, but he did say that he hoped that they could get this worked out because it would be nice for Charlotte to have the NBA All-Star Game.
Oh, really? So they may yank it. Well, you know what? Good for them if they do. American Airlines, which employs 14,000 people in the state and the second largest hub in Charlotte, along with other companies like Apple, Dow Chemical, PayPal, Red Hat, Biogen, are all very critical of this law,
and
as they should be.
And what's interesting, too, is that in North Carolina, you've got a very large segment of the tech population. There's a place that they call the Triangle, which is Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, all within, you know, 30 miles of each other. And that has become one of those big tech hubs, like Austin, you know, like Seattle. That's one of them. And, of course, you've got Facebooks and Apples and Salesforce, which came down hard on Indiana when they passed that law and then tried to revise it. Indiana lost $60 billion. It was $60 million in tourist revenue over that piece of legislation that is not unlike what was passed in North Carolina and what is sitting on the governor's desk in Georgia.
Well, and so, Pat McCrory, he signed it. The governor of North Carolina signed it yesterday. So, jeez.
Well, and the North Carolina...
It just blows me away, you know, that they always make it about bathrooms. I mean, it's... That was the tipping point. Well,
you know, what they're trying to do is, you know, they're trying to give people who are, you know, call it what you will, but they don't like the gay, lesbian, transgender lifestyle. It offends them bitterly.
That's fine, but
so they're using religion.
That's right.
Like they've always used religion in the South to define acceptance and exclusion.
You know what? John Libertini, Funny or Die, did this piece about North Carolina. And do we have that? Yeah, let's play.
North Carolina, home of beaches, mountains, and an extremely homophobic governor. Now you can experience the beautiful outdoors, cityscapes, and incredible ignorance by hang gliding backwards in time, racing to the wrong side of history in a kayak, teaching your children to judge others while frolicking in the waves, and enjoying our waterfalls without fear of gay people falling on you. If you're grossed out when same-sex couples order wedding cakes, or if you're obsessed with who is in what bathroom, or if you think religious liberty laws only apply to your religion, North Carolina's for you. We're resisting social progress rather than helping people in need, because North Carolina stands for nobody cares.
Amen.
Well, what's interesting is that Rob Reiner, film director, ex-actor Rob Reiner, says that he will no longer film in North Carolina, or won't until they change that law.
Well, wait till see what happens if Georgia pulls this, because there's a lot of show business there as is in Carolina.
No kidding. Yes, well, the governor there, Nathan Deal, has until May 3rd to sign or veto that bill. It has been passed by both houses of the legislature there. And what's incredibly interesting is that Atlanta is one of the gayest cities in America.
I know. You told me that today. I'm blown away by that. Pun intended. Yes.
It is true. It is true. I mean,
well, it's just insane. It really is, all of this. I mean, I honestly, you know what I think this is all about? It's all blowback from the, Supreme Court decision.
Well, of course it is.
Yes.
And, you know, there are a lot of people, I think, that would be less opposed to gay marriage if they'd called it something else, as opposed to marriage. Well, you know, look, I'm just telling you. I mean, there might have been that. And when you talk about groups like the gay rights groups, the animal rights groups, the NAACP, there is a fervor that gets on everyone's nerves. It's like, does it have to be in my face all the time? Well, unfortunately, that's how that game goes when you're fighting for progress and you're fighting to get out from under discrimination. But those are a couple of the things that are in play there. And then, of course, there are the people who are religiously and personally repulsed by those lifestyles.
Well, that's fine. You know what? But you started this entire conversation by saying the LGBTQ community in Charlotte wanted transgender bathrooms.
Well, no, there was a non-discrimination law that was passed. And as part of that law, there was a provision that any new construction, any new development in that city had to not only include a men's and a women's room, but a gender-neutral bathroom.
And that was the tipping point. So if that wouldn't have been in there, then they probably, this wouldn't, wow, I'd like scratching my head. I'd like to think that it wouldn't have happened.
Well, you know, that was the tipping point.
Just
if not
one.
That, maybe something else. But, I mean, that's the kind of thing that causes people's heads to explode.
Right.
I mean, over at UC Berkeley, you know, or in the UC system, there are now 6 different boxes for gender identity. The state legislature says the state asked for it, but there aren't a lot of people who remember saying, yeah, go ahead, spend your money on that and create more confusion, not less.
I would check every single one of them. Why not?
And, you know, none of them resemble man, woman, boy, girl.
Right. Just check every single one of them, or choose none. All of the above or none.
So, I think it's worth noting, though, listen to this. Walt Disney threatening to no longer film movies in Georgia, and that's the home to Coca-Cola, Home Depot,
Real Housewives,
Drex.
Yeah, I know, but
Delta Airlines.
There's a lot of show business, of course.
No, the Real Housewives would be fine. You know what is it the women say? You know, it's great to have a gay friend.
Yes, who's going to do their hair? Get their hair did.
Well, you saw what happened to Pam Davis in Kentucky. Her hair looks like because nobody will do it.
Enough said. All right. Thank you very much, John Libertini. Batman versus Superman, a Brian Pelletier review coming up next on KGOA 10.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the MGM Grand for tonight's main event, Batman versus Superman. Batman first to arrive. Oh, the Batmobile screeches up. He's leaping into the ring. What an entrance. And now, looking for Superman's arrival? Oh, he just walks in. Okay, yeah. Both fighters now in their corners, ready to go. Batman high-fives his entourage and starts punching in the air, his cape rippling with every thrust. Superman just staring all by himself. Here we go. Batman explodes from his corner, fire in his eyes, his arm cocked and ready to... Superman just blew him up. Literally, with one punch. His guts are still landing. What the hell were we thinking? Duh, he's Superman! This was worse than Pacquiao Mayweather. Oh, I think that was his liver. Well, good night from the MGM Grand, where Batman became Splatman.
Oh, I'm not sure that really happened, though, but Brian Pelletier saw the movie today. So I have to start with Tim Seeger, our film critic from the San Francisco Film Critics Association. He liked it for what it was.
Oh, good for him.
Now, you know, what I love, and he said, if you're into the genre, you're going to love it. So now, you know, we have Brian Pelletier here, who is seriously into all of these things, which I'm not. So, you know, explain it to the people.
Yeah, no, I really am, and I really, really, really wanted to like this movie. I'm a big Superman fan. I have a photograph of me in the back of my dad's pickup truck wearing a Superman costume for Halloween.
Please share that with us.
So my fandom of Superman runs very deep to when I was like 3 years old. And I love Batman, and I love the Batman films that recently came out, the Christopher Nolan ones. They were probably some of the best superhero movies I've ever seen, but there just wasn't enough backstory there for me with the characters. I found it really difficult to care much about Batman because it was almost like he's this new character with what's his name playing?
Ben Affleck. Which everybody was saying, you know, before you saw it, that he did an incredible job.
So there were bright spots in the movie. I really liked the job that he did, Ben Affleck as Batman. He was a good Batman, but I just feel like we were kind of getting to know him all over again. And then Wonder Woman arrives on scene, but she just arrives on scene, and there's not a whole lot of backstory. I would have loved to get a little bit more backstory on her, where she got her powers, what she's all about.
Well, see, this is DC setting this up, and Warner Brothers setting this up for all of these individual movies. Am I right?
Yeah, there's a Wonder Woman movie on the way. I believe there's a movie with The Flash that's also on the way. This is a prequel to the Dawn... This is the Dawn of Justice, so the Justice League movie is due out in a couple years. That's definitely happening. The Wonder Woman movie is definitely happening for sure.
So they got a lot of big bank hanging on this.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I felt is, you know, the Avengers and Marvel really set up all of those characters. You know, you have your Captain America, your Thor.
Iron Man,
of course.
Yes.
And even the Hulk. And the Hulk movies weren't all that great, but... You know, at least it kind of set them up with their backstories.
Captain
and
America.
Then they all came together to form the Avengers. And then
that
you kind of understood what their differences were and where, you know, when they weren't getting along, you kind of understood that as well. So I just wish there was more of that with this movie. It would have been nice to have a little bit more setup, I think.
So it was awkward.
A little bit. I mean, it's fun. If you like explosions and fast-moving movies, I mean, it was nonstop action. So that part of it was good. But I feel like if I was going to bring my wife, who's more of a casual fan, she
wouldn't
quite get it.
Right. So, yeah, I'm doubting that I would either. But, you know, and then the other thing that Tim Seeger said, it's pretty dark. So this is not really a kid's, you know, for small kids. I mean, you're teenagers, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's probably... Yeah, it's definitely darker than the Avengers. It's probably about as dark as some of your X-Men movies. Like, those are a little bit darker superhero movies, and I would say they're probably closer to the X-Men than they are the Avengers. But that being said, Batman versus Superman just today made $169.5 million, which is it's a pre-summer opening record for a day.
Wow. Well, yeah. They need to make $800 million quickly.
Well, yeah. they're part of the way
I
there.
I guess they will.
I mean, that's just one day. So if you stretch that out over this weekend, they'll probably be about halfway there.
All right. Well, you know, it's really interesting about these movies being dark. One of my neighbors, she took her kids to see Deadpool. Mm-hmm. And she was thinking that was a kid's movie. I'm like, oh
no.
My God, no. She said, no, it was so weird. She said, I didn't know whether to leave or not because her kids are like 11 and 10, 11.
Yeah, I mean, you got to pay attention to those ratings.
Right,
they're there for a reason.
Yeah, right?
I mean, holy smokes.
Yeah. All right, so how was Amy Adams and Lawrence Fishburne?
They were both good.
Lois Lane and Perry White.
Yeah,
Jesse Eisenberg.
I would really say the standout performance was Affleck by far.
Oh, really?
And then Gal Gadot, who plays Wonder Woman, was also very good the short amount of time that she was in the movie. And those two really kept it going. There was kind of like this back and forth between Batman and Wonder Woman during the whole movie. They were kind of playing like cat and mouse, and it was, you know, to follow that relationship through the movie was interesting.
Well, now I have friends who are into all of this, just like you are.
Yeah.
And I know that this is, sounds like a misogynistic thing that people are saying, but my friends are saying they're not down with the Wonder Woman thing.
Why is that?
I don't know.
Well, they should be. I mean, she got a standing ovation when she first appeared on screen, like in her Wonder Woman costume.
Oh, well, that's cool.
People were clapping in the theater, standing up.
Maybe they are being misogynistic. Yes,
I'll
tell them that.
She is a badass female character.
Well, you know what it plays to? It plays to that, can a woman really play a superhero?
Yeah.
To that mentality. So, you know, I just...
And in this movie, she definitely does, and she plays it well. I would
say
that. I'm looking forward to the standalone movie, like I said, because I want to see a little bit more of her backstory and understand why she got to the point that she's at in this movie. I think that would be really helpful to people that go.
All right. Well, now you know. Okay.
That being said, I wouldn't necessarily say don't go see the movie. I just really, 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 really wanted to like it a lot more than I did.
I know. Well, and he really did because he was trying to get debut tickets, then he couldn't do that, and he was waiting and waiting and waiting, and yeah. When did you go?
I went this morning.
Oh, you went this morning?
At 9 o'clock in the morning, I went to IMAX, and I woke up, walked the dog, and had to go see this movie.
All right, Brian Pelletier.
Part of my homework.
Thank you very much. Okay. All right. We're going to get to the Late Night Late Show wrap-up. That's on the way on the Drex Radio Show next on KGO 810.